What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
This is the new Weight Watchers. It works for members like JoJo, who's learning simple, healthy habits, Sharia, who's making progress with meds, and Kim, who still gets to eat what she loves. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now it's your turn. Watch your life open up. Watch your story shift. Watch what you're capable of. Watch it work. Get started today at WeightWatchers.com.
We're all kind of, I'm a woman, you're Latin, you're black, so
we're all silenced, but we all have our various disenfranchisements.
Are we talking about Me Too?
Me Too and just like racism and everything.
We were recording all of that, but don't worry, I'm not going to release it. I'm just going to blackmail you with it.
The sound quality will be terrible, by the way, because we weren't holding mics up.
Don't worry, it's obviously.
I'll deny it's me on the tape. I go, that's Mel Gibson talking.
No, you could, you have actually really good.
Hello and welcome to the Katie Halper Show. On today's episode, we speak to two historians. Justin Williams is an assistant professor of history at City College of New York. He's also a comedian, for real. Then we talk to Gerald Horn, a professor of history and African American studies at Houston University. Make sure that you sign up for our Patreon at patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow so you can hear bonus episodes. For this week, we bring you our extended interview with Dr. Justin Williams and Dr. Gerald Horn. You can find us on iTunes and SoundCloud. Rate and review us on iTunes. Like us on Facebook. Make sure you check out my op-ed in the Daily News called Mayor de Blasio, It's Not Too Late to Honor the Legacy of Erica Garner, and I implore him to make the very basic changes that Erica Garner had asked of him. It's based on my interview with her. And in case listeners don't know, Erica Garner was the daughter of Eric Garner, who was killed in a chokehold. I spoke to Erica Garner a few weeks before she died of a heart attack at the age of 27, leaving behind two children, and she never stopped fighting for justice against police brutality to honor her father, but also on behalf of all people who are victims of police brutality or potential victims. So please go to the Daily News and look for that and share it, because I would really like Bill de Blasio to feel some pressure to actually do some of the things she asked for. Again, they're very simple. It's to fire the police officer who killed her father, release his records, and make the chokehold illegal. And you can find that pinned to my Twitter page if you go to twitter.com/KTHalps. Again, that's twitter.com/KTHalps. Please share it so that Bill de Blasio actually does the right thing. Let me just check in with my main man, my side piece, my platonic side piece, Gabe Pacheco.
What's going on, everybody? Platonic side piece, Gabe Pacheco in the house.
How's
today,
it going?
I'm feeling great. I'm flying high on some Tylenol Cold Max medication.
Nice.
Yeah. So we're feeling it. I'm feeling it. I'm comfortably numb.
Nice. I like that. Nice deep cut by some really white band. I don't know. Fish or the other
Pink
one?
Floyd.
Pink Floyd. I always confuse them. Yeah.
Yes, ma'am. So, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am.
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir.
You got it.
Yes, sir. May I have another interesting episode of the Katie Halper Show? How's that for a segue? You can hear the Katie Halper Show every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WBAI. That's 99.5 WBAI.org. We're really excited. We have someone live in the flesh, Justin Williams, comedian, scholar, smart guy. He has his own show. He's been on the show before. He's a vet. He's a recidivist, a Katie Halper recidivist. And
we tried to set him free and he came right back.
Yeah, he can't help it. He wishes he could quit us. But he
can't, though. He's addicted to the show.
Might as well face it. You're addicted to the show. So put your hands together for Justin Williams. Woo! Justin, tell us about yourself. You're one of the smartest comedians out there, I'd say.
Oh, God bless you for saying something like that. That's too much.
No, it's too little.
Thank you. What should I say about myself? I'm a comedian. I'm a Sagittarius.
Nice.
I teach history at the City College of New York.
I'd love to sit in on one of your history classes sometime. Yeah, what's the syllabus, man? Do we have like what are we studying this semester?
I'll be teaching Africa since independence at the Uptown campus, the main campus of City College, in this spring semester. So feel free to just drop in.
Can we?
Absolutely, yeah.
All right, Katie Halper Show goes to college at Justin Williams.
Yeah.
Ben Jealous invited us to be graduate students at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton. Remember, we were going to go do that, like an Ernest movie. Ernest goes to whatever. Katie and Gabe go to Princeton. But we'll go to CUNY also. My mom used to teach at LaGuardia.
Oh, very cool. Yeah. Very cool. Yeah, go to my website, justinwilliamscomedy.com. I perform all over this great great region, this great country,
this great
world. Catch a date. I got my album Mostly Woke is out on iTunes and Spotify and Amazon.
Oh, nice.
You know, since late October, it's been streamed over 100,000 times.
Nice. So we'll play some excerpts from it if that's
please do.
Good. Yeah.
This is a backlash moment, but it's the same thing. Like, I'm black, so I get this. Here's what Donald Trump is. Have you ever talked to a black person that still insists that OJ's innocent? It's the same fucking mentality. That black person knows damn well at this point that OJ is guilty as a motherfucker. But they're not supporting OJ because of anything that OJ has ever done or said. They are supporting OJ because it pisses you off. That's what the Trump thing is. They will support anything Donald Trump does as long as liberals don't like it. Donald Trump could have a gun to their wife's head and they're like, does Huffington Post have an opinion on this? If Huffington Post doesn't like Donald Trump having a wife to my gun said, like, bye, baby.
Please do.
And then your album before that was Black and Comfortably
Middle Class.
Yeah.
That was a video. That was like a special.
I don't even know if I can even call it a special,
but yeah, it was like a concert film.
What? And you have a very funny stand-up show, monthly stand-up show?
I have two monthly stand-up shows.
Okay, tell us about it.
I'm double Hudson it. I have one at the Creek in the Cave, Death Comedy Jam.
And can I just say that I attended that one and performed at it about a week ago, and it's the best. If you want to watch Justin Williams do fantastic banter, he's one of my favorites to watch up top with Akash Basim.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
Yeah, you guys are just a dynamic duo up there.
That show is great because it's just like, it's just what happens when, you know, alcohol and no script. So it's great. You get to really explore the space.
Yeah, no safety net, baby.
Yeah, yeah. Let's go up there and try it. And then we have a monthly in New Jersey in downtown Newark called the Brick City Comedy Review. That's a very fun show as well. It's very nice. Very nice.
Yeah, and I one of the funniest things that I ever saw that you and Akash, your co-host, do at Death Comedy Jam is, which I've also performed in and always had a great time in. One of the funniest things was when you and Akash talked about Mel Gibson and you analyzed what he had said to his wife.
You're not lying to me about fake tits. So they look ridiculous. Get rid of them, why don't you? Anyway, keep them if you want, you know, but they're too big and they look stupid. They look like some Vegas bitch. They look like a Vegas whore. Mm-hmm. And you go around sashaying around in your tight clothes and stuff. I won't stand for that anymore.
And you kind of triage the most offensive parts of it?
Yeah, that the parts that everyone was most offended by wasn't even the like most offensive part when you actually broke it down.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was the racial stuff was actually just as hardcore as the gender stuff.
You look like a fucking bitch on heat. And if you get raped by a pack of n****s, it'll be your fault. Because you provoked it. You are provocatively dressed all the time with your fake boobs you feel you have to show off. Tight outfits, you see your pussy.
But even within the racial stuff, he said a pack of N-words.
And if you get raped by a pack of n****s,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And your point was like, it's not even the N-word part. Like, it's the pack part.
It's the pack part.
Yeah,
yeah, that's actually the most offensive.
And
yeah,
dehumanizing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a...
He's a renaissance man of bigotry and hate.
It's like the most hateful sentence because there's also sexual violence at the top of the sentence. So we were talking about it. It's like, that could be the most hateful sentence.
Yeah.
Ever uttered.
He's a masterful
by a person.
Masterful. He's like Shakespeare, very efficient.
Yeah, and it's
economical.
Just, and it's always good to revisit those tapes. Like, yeah, I listen to the Mel Gibson tapes every once in a while because it's just like it is one of those things where it is like unfiltered wildness. It goes what is a thing that's like a 10 on
right,
a 10
right.
scale?
It's like then I'm gonna tapes. Go 11. Well, also what I like about him is when he got arrested and he called the cop like a Jew.
I read to him the officer's account of the words he used that night. Expletive Jews. And to officer me, are you a Jew?
And the Jews are responsible for all the wars in the world.
Because yeah. I just felt that it was cool to be stereotyped as something we're not usually.
Yeah, when is the last time you've seen like an episode of, you know, Chips?
Yeah, with Goldberg.
Or DJ Booker right. with his
Officer
new sidekick.
Goldberg, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Sergeant Stein.
Meyerowitz.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah. On this episode of SVU.
Well,
Detective
oh, you know,
Shlomo.
No, you know who they do have? Munch. They have that guy,
Munch.
Richard Belzer, but he's the first. He broke the gefilte fish ceiling.
Yes.
The matzah ceiling.
Yeah.
But also, you said that Mel Gibson, given how racist he is, you and Akash were like, he deserves an Oscar for that because he was such a good friend to Danny Glover.
Yeah, that was good acting.
Right? Because you really thought he loved Danny Glover.
For four films.
Yeah.
I gotta start. I'm glad you remember all this because yeah. I was like, this is actually a pretty good bit.
Yeah, you bring
it's
it back.
It's not timely anymore. It's like,
no,
from
just
like,
wait.
Isn't it from
wait.
Like 2009?
Yeah, that's but something will come up. Mel Gibson will be nominated. You can pretend you saw a movie the other day.
Well, he's like back now. He's been rehabilitated. Like he's like at award shows and he's on
there
stage.
There you go.
They even put
Thank
him
God
in
for Me Too and all the rapists. He's a relative
that's what he
prince. Yeah.
They had him and Danny Glover present like an AFI award together.
It's an honor to be here.
You look great, man.
Hey, thanks, yeah.
Man, it's not coming.
It's been, I haven't seen Danny for many years. It's donkey's years.
And it was like, everyone was so happy to see him together. But it was like, was there ever a conversation where Danny's like, hey,
yeah.
man, what's, you know, because Danny's like a radical
yeah,
racial
super,
justice leftist.
Yeah, like who goes to Venezuela and like, you know, works with Chavez. I mean, I'm not, that's obviously for me, that's not a dig. But yeah, he's not just like mainstream lib. He's actually radical, yeah.
What were their conversations at the craft service table, like in between takes during part four? Like, did they need Joe Pesci to come along and like, you know, really lubricate the conversation again and like ease the tensions? Right? Like in part two, they're battling apartheid.
I think there must be some mistake.
Say what?
I don't think you really want to go to South Africa.
Why not?
Because you're black.
You are. He is.
Of course I'm black. That's why I want to go to South Africa. To join up with my oppressed brothers. To take up the struggle against the tyranny of the racist, fascist, white minority regime.
Fascist, white regime.
One man, one vote.
One man, one vote.
Free South Africa, you dumb son of a bitch.
You dumb son of a bitch.
Look, I've heard just about as much as I want to.
Hey,
I'm going to ask.
Hey, look here.
And I'm sure that like Mel Gibson was like, you know, apartheid isn't so bad.
It's another testament to what a good actor he is.
It's
you know, he probably had to like really get into character. Being anti-apartheid was like a real struggle for him.
I also liked it that when it looked like it was all falling apart for him, he had that movie. The first reboot attempt of Mel Gibson was The Beaver, where he had a beaver puppet on his hand.
Oh my God, I forgot about that.
Bloody hell, look at you. Who are you? I'm the Beaver Water, and I'm here to save your damn life.
It was a movie that was supposed to be a drama, but accidentally became a hilarious comedy.
Have a look at this.
A beaver?
It's the future.
Maybe that's the first step for all celebrity rehabs, is they're like, okay, you did something egregious, now let's give you a Muppet to work with.
This is a joke, right?
No, son, it's a fresh start.
Like, Louis C.K. is going to come back, but they'll have, like a little a cute, snuggly little hedgehog that he's got to talk to the whole movie.
Yeah.
It could be a woodchuck.
I just wanted to throw in a curveball. But
do you think he's finished, by the way? Do you think
Louis C.K.?
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's borderline, right?
Borderline.
I say give it four years.
Four more years.
4 years. That's what
four
I got.
More years
I got
be
money
me.
On he'll be back in 4 years.
Okay, what do you say? What are you putting money on?
I don't know, because there's an element of there. I mean, it, you know, it's the work relationship. It's the surprising. It's the blocking. You know
the
what
door,
I mean?
The
like,
blocking the door.
Yeah, the blocking the door. Like, you know what I mean? Like, so it goes into a category to where it's like, I don't know.
Right.
You know, it's like some people tried to, you know, comics that I respect, but in all fairness, his peers tried to kind of minimize that. I'm like, you can't be like, oh, it was just that. It actually takes on a different psychological level.
Yes, that's a major abuse. That's not just like not picking up signals. That's like, I'm going to make it so it's hard for this person to exit. I'm going to make egress. I just want
to
use that word.
And I know somebody he did it to that didn't come forward. So that means even the examples that are there, there's right. probably more of them too. So it's, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So maybe not. He's not going to get mainstream fame again, but he could go back to sort of like a cult status, like a YouTube star thing, you know, because he never blew up doing a podcast. But now he's burned all of his bridges. So I could see him sort of in a cabin in the woods just speaking into the void.
I would like him to become a YouTube star. I'd be like Louis C.K. to work with like Chocolate Rain. That would be a good.
He could like join the Hillary's back from the resistance, but back when there was the run, she was like in the woods. They could have like, they could like co-sublet a, do a WeWork in the woods, in a cabin or something. Are you working on anything in terms of scholarship, or are you focusing more on teaching the youths?
All my stuff is like either published already or in the pipeline to be published. So I'm getting ready to start a new project, and I'm going to write about the rise of the African consumer class.
Ooh.
That's what I'm going to write about.
Wait, so when you say African consumer class, are we talking about loot crates and blue aprons ending up in Kenya? What do we mean by that? I'm not quite sure.
I'm talking about Nigerians that charter private jets to go shopping in London.
Oh, wow.
To go back to their Lagos apartment, the two properties. I'm talking about Angolan heiresses. That buy billions of dollars of the Portuguese stock market and buy Rembrandts from Portuguese.
Wow. I guess I was looking at the world through some rose-tinted glasses. I was like, ooh, a rising middle class. And you're like, nope. The 0.0001% oligarchy.
So it gets, but lines get blurred, right? So there is a people that they're a global elite that are wealthy, but the cost of living is so low that what is considered middle class in a place like Nairobi would be considered wealthy to us, but it's not globally wealth. So like middle class could be like, oh, sure, I have like a 6-bedroom house. My kids go to private school. I have a driver. That could be like an upper middle class existence. But also the oligarchy is like, I Instagram videos of me pouring out Cristal on top of my Rolex.
There are instances of this in Mexico as well, where there's like rich Mexican kids of Instagram, and it's just like the children of the narcos and like children of bureaucrats that shouldn't have any of this money, but have like yachts and like gold AK-47s and just like have new Maseratis parachuted down from the skies onto their like compounds for their birthdays.
Yeah.
And there's this extreme display of affluence and wealth in third world countries that's, perplexing, to say the least.
It is. Well, so it's sort of odd, right? It's because it's like, of course, oligarchy is bad. Of course, the economic, but it's in the situations of the deprivation and the exploitation was so extreme that in some cases they represent sort of a positive trend because they're moving some of this money back into their home country's economy. And sort of there's a sort of an infrastructure to sort of maintain the rich. But of course, it's like the divide between the rich and the poor. It's like, so you get like insane inequality, right? It's like the kind of things that you see in like a place like a really well-developed economy like South Africa, you're going to start seeing across Africa now, where it's going to be like you have people that are literally living in existence that you might envy as a New Yorker, living next to people that don't have running water and electricity.
When you say Africa, though, isn't it like you're not talking about Morocco, Algeria? Do North African countries get offended that you're erasing them?
No, because they erase themselves through like sort of. So the way African studies is broken up is, you know, sort of North Africa sort of is sort of almost sort of absorbed into the Middle East.
Right. MENA.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Middle East, North Africa.
Yeah. And so Sub-Saharan Africa. And it's very much a complete racial division between the Sahara Desert. Right. It's like, oh, black people live down here. Yeah, and it's, you know, you can't even say Arabs, right? Because there's like Berbers and, right, you know, all kinds of different groups, right? But you say those other people live up here. And those people living in North Africa, a lot of times sort of sometimes engage in that because it gives them sort of a privileged position within the racial order.
Right.
Because some people will say, oh, culturally, it's like, but no, if you go just to the southern tip of the Sahara, those people are Muslims as well. But they're different.
Right.
You know, they're black, though. So that makes them different, you know.
And tell us about your book, Pan-Africanism in Ghana. African Socialism, Neoliberalism, and Globalization.
Yes. So Pan-Africanism was a political movement that came out of the sort of the aftermath of slavery that said that all African peoples, you know, in the diaspora sort of had a claim and, you know, should even return to Africa. So you see it, you know, manifest itself in the, you know, the Garvey movement and Pan-African
Garvey
Congress movements. So I was writing about how that particular movement in the context of decolonization in the Cold War starts off as an anti-colonial and a lot of times anti-capitalist sort of movement in Africa. But by the time you get to economic reform in the early 80s, that entire legacy actually becomes part of a heritage tourist infrastructure in Ghana that's part of like propping up the capitalist project there. So it's about how you can even you. It's like it's so to sort of simplify it. It's the way that African countries, even if they had a socialist past, can sell socialism. Mm. So it's just basically the African version of the Che T-shirt.
Exactly. Both Gabe and I, we were about to make that joke, right?
Yeah.
We were
yeah.
about to jump in and be like, "So you mean it's the Che T-shirt, but in Africa?"
Yeah, yeah. Or like you go to Chile and they've got Victor Jara T-shirts. You know, he was the singer who was killed. In the stadiums right after the junta took over with Pinochet. But so socialist chic.
Yeah. Right.
Yep. TM. Copyrighted.
And what about, can you talk about Martin Luther King? Because, of course, this week is Martin Luther King Day. And we're used to, or I'm used to, Republicans battling, you know, claiming Martin Luther King. But I got into a thing, not to be too Twitter-ish, but I quoted a couple years ago, I wrote a piece. It was like, the 12 most anti-capitalist quotes of Martin Luther King. And, you know, people usually really like it. Sorry, the 11 most anti-capitalist quotes from Martin Luther King. You see, I also have a dream, which is that I had made 12 instead of 11. And this year, I kind of made it a little provocative. I said, I tweeted some MLK quotes that centrists aren't particularly fond of. But I didn't think that people would actually push back against this and accuse me of cherry-picking his words to fit an agenda.
It's not an agenda. He was very much in favor of socialism and socialist policies.
But now we are dealing with issues that cannot be solved without the nation spending billions of dollars and undergoing a radical redistribution of economic power.
Yes, yes.
We must also realize that the problems of racial injustice and economic injustice cannot be solved without a radical redistribution of political and economic power.
America's opportunity to help bridge the gulf between the haves and the have-nots. There's nothing new about poverty. What is new is that we now have the techniques and the resources to get rid of poverty. And the real question is whether we have the will.
And he also has a socialist inner circle, like Bayard Rustin is a socialist. Yeah. Was a socialist at the time, yeah.
And apparently JFK tried to like strong arm him against hanging out with communists. And I just heard historian Gerald Horn. He was talking about how JFK took him into the Rose Garden and was like, don't associate with communists anymore. And MLK was like, sure thing. And then he went and did it anyway. Now we have a special treat. I interviewed Professor Gerald Horn, the very historian I just mentioned, the very historian I heard talk about Martin Luther King and JFK in the Rose Garden. Gerald Horn is a professor of history and African American studies at Houston University and the author of books, including Paul Robeson, The Artist as Revolutionary, W.E.B. Du Bois, A Biography, The Deep South, The U.S., Brazil, and the African Slave Trade. Hoping to talk to you about Martin Luther King Day, given that, of course, it was Monday. I tweeted out an article I had written. It was just a listicle, but it was 11 anti-capitalist quotes from Martin Luther King. And there was a huge backlash, and I was accused of cherry-picking his words, his writing, his ideas by people who, I guess, would call themselves liberal, but were very offended by the idea that someone would try to frame him as anti-capitalist. So I wanted to talk to a historian who's actually an expert in this area.
And sure, let's get it on.
Yeah, how would you respond to these people?
I would say to these individuals that they are overreacting to the strength of conservatism in the United States, and probably they feel that if the true Martin Luther King Jr. would be revealed and exposed, then perhaps it could lead to a backlash against the King holiday, a backlash against, quote, liberals, unquote, because they would be closely associated with Martin Luther King. But I think that they should relax. Number one, because the truth shall set you free. And number two, I think that too often liberals are rather nervous about the strength of the right, which I totally understand because they are very powerful, and they're powerful in all classes within the Euro-American community. But at this particular moment, I think because of the global situation, we can push back against the right. And so the liberals should just relax.
Martin Luther King, obviously, he's incredibly whitewashed, no pun intended, by the right. But even people who are liberal are trying. I think that sometimes this the image that people are taught about him is makes him a much more moderate person and less militant and less radical. How would you describe his politics, his ideas, his ideology?
I would say that Martin Luther King fundamentally was a social democrat, and that's exposed and revealed by the last campaigns he was involved in. Number one, protesting with workers, organized labor in Memphis, Tennessee, for higher wages and better better working conditions.
You are reminding not only Memphis, but you are reminding the nation that it is a crime for people to live in this rich nation and receive starvation wages. All labor has dignity.
Yes.
Number two, the Poor People's Campaign, which was an attempt to tie up Washington with poor people of various backgrounds, ancestries, and ethnicities until their demands were met. Then the third point that I would make is look at who surrounded Martin Luther King. I mean, first of all, you may recall that it was in the early 1960s that President Kennedy took King into the Rose Garden to escape the surveillance at the White House he thought was operative of the FBI, to warn King to distance himself from one of his key advisors, who was Jack O'Dell. Jack O'Dell was supposedly part of the U.S. Communist Party. Certainly, he was a labor organizer with what had been one of the left-led unions that was then purged during the Cold War, speaking of the National Maritime Union. Mm. And Martin Luther King pledged that he would distance himself from Jack, but he did not.
Nice.
And of course, that was picked up on FBI wiretaps and all the rest, which leads J. Edgar Hoover to say that Martin Luther King was a notorious liar. By the way, Jack O'Dell used to be the chair of the board of Pacifica and is still in the land of the living in self-imposed exile in Vancouver, British Columbia.
I'm going there. Mention, that's so funny. I should track him down.
I should also mention that many people understandably mentioned the speech that King made in April 1967, almost a year to the day before he was assassinated. And it was a speech in Upper Manhattan at Riverside Church denouncing and renouncing the war in Vietnam.
As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. I have tried to offer them my deepest compassion while maintaining my conviction that social change comes most meaningfully through nonviolent action. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They ask if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems, to bring about the changes it wanted. Their questions hit home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. For the sake of those boys, for the sake of this government, for the sake of the hundreds of thousands trembling under our violence.
Which got into hot water, not only with the White House, but with many editorial boards in so-called prestigious newspapers.
He predicted their criticisms within his very speech, because he talks about how people say to him, why are you talking about peace? Why are you talking about militarism? You're supposed to just care about civil rights. Why are you talking about economics? And of course, that's what a lot of the criticism was.
Well, that's right.
Many persons have questioned me about the wisdom of my path. Why are you speaking about the war, Dr. King? Why are you joining the voices of dissent? Peace and civil rights don't mix, they say.
And obviously, that is fallacious thinking.
When I hear them, though I often understand the source of their concern, I'm nevertheless greatly saddened. for such questions mean that the inquirers have not really known me, my commitment or my calling. Indeed, their questions suggest that they do not know the world in which they live. In the light of such tragic misunderstanding, I deem it of signal importance to try to state clearly, and I trust concisely, why I believe that the path from Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, the church in Montgomery, Alabama, where I began my pastorate, leads clearly to this sanctuary tonight. There are obvious and almost facile connections between the war in Vietnam and the struggle I and others been waging in America.
Because how can you attend to the domestic problems of health care and education and the needs of senior citizens without cutting the gargantuan military budget? Obviously, the money has to come from somewhere, and it has to come from the 1% and from the Pentagon. And that still holds true today.
A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death.
But I would also point you to a speech that King made in February 1968, weeks before being assassinated, when he was speaking on behalf of Freedom Ways magazine, which was a left-leaning magazine targeting the black community, of which Jack was an editor. Mm. And in that speech, King praised W.E.B. Du Bois, rejected anti-communism, the reigning gospel of the U.S. ruling elite at that point, which he saw as leading the United States into the quagmire in Vietnam, not to mention partnerships with apartheid South Africa and racist Rhodesia.
It is a sad fact that because of comfort, complacency, a morbid fear of communism, and our proneness to adjust to injustice, the Western nations that initiated so much of the revolutionary spirit of the modern world have now become the arch anti-revolutionaries. This has driven many to feel that only Marxism has the revolutionary spirit. Communism is a judgment. And in a sense, communism is a judgment of our failure to make democracy real.
I'm sure your listeners know that W.E.B. Du Bois was the founder of the NAACP, but who in 1961, before going into self-imposed exile in Ghana, West Africa, joined the U.S. Communist Party. And so when King praised Dr. Du Bois, that was a red flag to the bull of the U.S. ruling elite, and I might also say a goodly number of liberals as well.
That was Professor Gerald Horn, and now more from Justin Williams.
So yeah. that's sort of one of the things that my book deals with, because it's the some of the groups of people that engage with decolonizing Africa have socialist and communist political leanings. Yeah, they were part of the Civil Rights Coalition, and they're the kind of people that sort of get erased out of the civil rights narrative. Mm. But when Ghana becomes independent, they're all there because Ghana has a leftist on the world stage as its first president, Kwame Nkrumah. So he's considered the father of African independence.
This mid-20th century is Africa's. This decade is the decade of African independence. Forward then, to independence now. Tomorrow, the United States of Africa.
So Ghana becomes independent in 1957. So that's, you know, you're talking about pre-Voting Rights Act, pre-Civil Rights Act. And in 1957, Martin Luther King actually visits Ghana for the independence celebration. And because Kwame Nkrumah leads a campaign, which is called Positive Action, boycotts, strikes against the British government in order to achieve independence. And Martin Luther King actually flies back to the Dexter Avenue Church saying, hey, this black guy in Africa just used nonviolence as a way to beat the British Empire. If he can do that, then we can beat the local sheriff.
Wow.
It was hugely influential. And he, you know, sort of an African independence was very much inspirational to the civil rights movement. Because you have to remember, Kwame Nkrumah is dancing with the Duchess of Kent in 1957 as her equal as prime minister, while black people can't vote in the South.
Wow. Was the Duchess of Kent super woke or just
wow, that's like a Meghan Merkel moment, you know? It's royalty intermingling and then across racial lines. And so we see the African and Africans in the U.S., African Americans as part of the diaspora. We're seeing a connection with this is like even bigger than Pan-Africanism, where the where Martin Luther King is being affected positively by what's going on in Africa. That's pretty awesome. I didn't know that he had such a connection to an international circle.
No, I'm not from Ghana, but Africa is my mama, I believe, is what Dead Prez said. Paraphrasing MLK. Now I now know. Where you from, fool? No, I wasn't born in Ghana, but Africa is my mama,
and I did not end up here from bad karma or for people. What they yelled at an audience of white kids with dreadlocks in Montana.
I mean, I went to Wesleyan, so yeah. Connecticut. That's why we bucking holes in the ceiling when we hearing I'm an African. Tell us about Martin Luther King's political evolution, and lots of people kind of prop him up as the antithesis of Malcolm X. But it seems like there was some
absolutely towards the end they both moved towards actually sort of espousing a political economic position of the global left by the time that they are both assassinated.
What we must all see is that these are revolutionary times. All over the globe, men are revolting against old systems of exploitation. And out of the wounds of a frail world, new systems and of justice and equality are being born. The shirtless and barefoot people of the earth are rising up as never before. The people who sat in darkness have seen a great light. We in the West must support these revolutions.
They would drop bombs on African villages that would blow that village apart and everything in it. Man, woman, child, and baby. No outcry, no sympathy, no support, no concern, because the press didn't project it in such a way that it would be designed to get your sympathy.
And who are we supporting in Vietnam today? It's a man by the name of General Key, who fought with the French against his own people, and who said that the greatest hero of his life is Hitler. This is who we are supporting in Vietnam today. Oh, our government and the press generally won't tell us these things, but God told me to tell you this morning.
Imagine this. This is criminal. Here's a man who's a murderer. So the United States takes him, puts him over the Congo, and supports his government with your tax dollars.
And it's also trying to work across class and racial lines. Both of them also come to sort of that realization towards the end. And that's sort of the like thing, if you're a conspiracy theorist, that's when sort of assassinations start occurring, right? It's when Malcolm X renounces the racial separatism of the Nation of Islam and says, I want to work across national and I want to work across class lines to achieve a sort of common vision of social justice. You know, it's when Martin Luther King starts going across class and racial lines for the sanitation strike in Tennessee. When Fred Hampton starts organizing with the sons and daughters of Confederate coal miners in Chicago to achieve a common, with the Black Panthers, start organizing with them to achieve a common vision of social justice that he's then shotgunned right in his bed, like conveniently.
A lot of people don't understand the Black Panther Party's relationship with white mother country radicals. But what we're saying is that there are white people in the mother country that are for the same types of things that we are for, stimulating revolution in the mother country. And we said that we would work with anybody and form coalition with anybody that has revolution on their mind. Racism is an excuse used for capitalism. And we know that racism is just, it's a byproduct of capitalism. Everything would be all right if everything was put back in the hands of the people. And we're going to have to put it back in the hands of the people.
The great thing about the Bernie movement is the Bernie movement in some ways is sort of a revival of those things. And so I think that's sort of like a positive thing, even though Bernie's a little tricky on the specific issues of race, but he's very much about doing the pan class movement.
Right.
And so I think you can say that's a positive thing, that vision has now sort of been resurrected within the mainstream Democratic Party.
You say tricky, like he doesn't have the most articulate, well, what do you mean by tricky? And don't worry, this is a safe space. We allow Bernie criticism.
No, it's not. It's not a criticism at all. It's a guy that's a senator in Vermont.
Right.
You know, He's not used to dealing with those kinds of issues, you know. And
he
also
he didn't have a hot sauce in my bag line ready to go. Like, he didn't have the sort of he just wasn't exposed on a daily basis.
Yeah, because it takes a certain skill to sort of talk about those things. And then also in his mind, he might see it as sort of a lot of ways inconvenient for his overall message, because his populism sort of does resonate with elements of the Trump base. And so for him, it's like talking race is sort of the convenient sort of distraction that sort of can trigger those people and losing that part of
see,
this movement,
I feel
right?
like though he what he does is that he gives a populist message. He emphasizes class, and he does. I mean, I feel like he doesn't say like he doesn't use the language that Hillary people will use, which I think can be very alienating about checking your white male privilege if you're talking to a coal miner, right?
Yeah.
I think he does say like it's not, you know, we're trying to divide us, and it's not a black Latino brothers and sisters. They are not the enemy. Blah blah blah. And like it really frustrates me when people, not that you were doing this at all, but when people compare him to Trump as if it's a bad thing. It's like, no, you want someone to compete with Trump. You want the person to appeal, who's appealing to these people, to be like, yes, you're angry. I feel your pain. You're right to be angry, and blame income inequality as opposed to blame Mexicans and Muslims.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's, and that, I think that's, and that's why I supported Bernie. I have an interesting relationship. I very much supported Bernie and raised money for him. But as a comedian, I do enjoy Bernie supporters. Bernie supporters are very much still fighting that primary on Twitter.
Although, to be fair, so are
some Hillary people.
The difference is like we don't have that many mainstream voices, and they do. Like we don't have that many mainstream media voices or pundit voices. But I have a question. We do you know Noah Changa? She has a show called The Way with a Noah. She has a podcast called The Way with a Noah. Make sure you sign up for our Patreon so you can hear the rest of our chat with Justin Williams and Gerald Horn. Though they agree that Martin Luther King was indeed radical, they have very different opinions on how to defeat Trump and Trumpism and the role of multiracial organizing. Become Patreon subscribers at patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. To find out more about Justin Williams, you can go to justinwilliamscomedy.com. You can also find him on Twitter at Justin W. Comedy. You can find his comedy album, Mostly Woke, on Amazon and iTunes. Gerald Horn is a professor of history and African American studies at Houston University and the author of books, including Paul Robeson, The Artist as Revolutionary, W.E.B. Du Bois, A Biography, The Deep South, The U.S., Brazil, and the African Slave Trade, Cold War in a Hot Zone, The United States Confronts Labor and Independence Struggles in the British West Indies, Black and Red, W.B. Du Bois and the African-American Response to the Cold War, Black Liberation, Red Scare, Ben Davis and the Communist Party. He's written for Political Affairs, The Guardian. He's appeared on NPR, Democracy Now!, and The Real News. Make sure you check out my op-ed in the Daily News called Mayor de Blasio, It's Not Too Late to Honor the Legacy of Erica Garner, and I implore him to make the very basic changes that Erica Garner asked of him. It's based on my interview with her. And in case listeners don't know, Erica Garner was the daughter of Eric Garner, who was killed in a chokehold. I spoke to Erica Garner a few weeks before she died of a heart attack at the age of 27, leaving behind two children. And she never stopped fighting for justice against police brutality to honor her father, but also on behalf of all people who are victims or potential victims of police brutality. Please go to the Daily News and look for that and share it, because I would really like Bill de Blasio to feel some pressure to actually do some of the things she asked for. Again, they're very simple. It's to fire the police officer who killed her father, release his records, and make the chokehold illegal. And you can find that pinned to my Twitter page if you go to twitter.com/KTHelps. Again, that's twitter.com/KTHALPS. Please share it so that Bill de Blasio actually does the right thing. Thank you so much for listening to The Katie Halper Show. The Katie Halper Show is produced by Florence Burrow Adams with help from Joshua Bregman. Our theme song is by The Ballet.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.